Today, we want to discuss some of the problems of the Christian home. And this evening, we want to take a look at how to brighten up a dull marriage. I don't suppose anybody will be here because of the fact that you all have a bright marriage. I don't want you to take it personally because you may be able to be of Christian service to your neighbors who don't have a bright marriage. And you'll want to know what sort of a polishing compound to use to brighten it up a little bit. This topic that I want to speak to you this morning about is, in my way of thinking, a very important topic. Because our Christian homes have so many problems, it would take, we should at least get our heads together for a little while to talk about them. We have so many disturbances, so many distractions, so many problems trying to be the kind of Christians we want to be at home. I think you'll all agree at that. That we're just disturbed at home most of the time over the kind of Christians we are where we live. And we don't quite understand how to have a Christian home. We hear it from the pulpit oftentimes that how we should be living at home. We perhaps read it in magazines or other literature how we should be acting at home, and then we'd go home and we try to apply it, and all we can say is the devil stop me. It just doesn't work. I can only make it work part of the time. And I feel like a defeated Christian because I can't live it at home. Now, I'm fully aware of this when I talk to you like this because a lot of the things that I'm going to say to you about how to overcome some of the problems of the Christian home will be taken home and you'll try it and you'll drop it too because you can't make it work. We have to face the fact that each of us must work out our problems at home the very best that we know how before the Lord. And I hope that I can give you a little frame of reference so that you can at least have the satisfaction and the peace of mind that you're doing what God wants you to do with the problems at home. We're living in a day where it's come and go. It's chaos almost all of the time. There is no real stability. I don't suppose there's ever been a time in all of the history of mankind when so much happened in so short a time. And where everything is a total world, shall we say, not a community. Communities have lost their boundary lines. And people are learning that people elsewhere are interesting and they can get there in a hurry. For instance, a man, what period of time could a man do what one man did, play golf 3 times in 1 day. He played before breakfast in New York. He played around lunchtime in Chicago, and he played again in the late afternoon in Los Angeles. Now, when can you do that in any other period of life? But it's within the memory of our parents very easily. They can stop to think that they couldn't believe that people played golf in these 3 places. If they played golf at home, that's about the only place they ever played golf. Never thought about the similarity of communities and being a part of different communities. I'm becoming aware of that right now. As we have left Los Angeles and suddenly been transported into your community, and suddenly you make me feel right at home, and my wife and I have had a delightful experience just being part of you in this community, and it's just been a real wonderful experience just living here, and you've given us the feeling like we've always lived here in a sense, and that we sort of ought not to go and live someplace else. And yet I have to stop to think again that I do have another community that I'm a part of. And I have to go to that community. It's this type of dividedness of interest and movability, people moving around all the time, that gives us part of our troubles in our own home, really. We're like people that are going around with roots in the air. Our roots aren't in the ground. It's difficult. The current attitude toward morality is giving us some problems in our home. That it's not really something to be discouraged, this idea of divorce or loose living. It's, enjoy yourself. If it doesn't work one time, try again. Companies provide, many of our commercial interests provide opportunities for breaking the moral fabric of the home. As you know, with their parties, with some of the provisions they make for their businessmen when they're on their trips. Morality is actually discouraged rather than encouraged in many, many commercial interests. It's too bad. Men are tempted on every side to break their marriage vows. Women are tempted on every side. A mechanic for Sears and Roebuck out in our area who goes around from house to house repairing refrigerators and various appliances that their company needs to keep in maintenance says you would be surprised at how much women throw themselves at me when I come into the home and make themselves available to me. He says, it's awfully hard to be true to my wife if I didn't have some principles. This is the day in which we're living. When, if you want to be successful in selling your product, you better put a half or two-thirds naked girl someplace on the picture. You have to make some eye-catching appeal in terms of something sensual. The family is perhaps one of the most fragile institutions that we have now. We think of the church being almost a fragile institution, but nothing like the family. When a third of our marriages or more, depending upon the community, wind up in divorce. In our area in Los Angeles, approximately one half of all the school children come from broken homes. Now, I may not be that high in this community, but it is very high out our way. And some areas it probably is higher. In other areas, not so bad. But it's something that we ought to hang our heads in shame or bow our heads in prayer about. For our nation is a sinning nation, and it is a very disturbing day in which we live. And yet I would say I wouldn't want to live in any other period of time. I cannot think of any other period of time I'd rather be alive than today. And I mean it. Because God is working in a wonderful way in this day, just like He's always been working. And God is on the throne, and He loves me, and He is going to glorify Himself in this day, just like He has been glorifying Himself in days past. These are history-making days, and we're part of a world crisis. We're going to see tremendous things happen that our children are going to be reading about as crisis days, history-making days, and the Lord is in this, and we're part of a tremendous epoch in world history. Let's be thankful that we're living in a great day and realize that we have the same resources today that have always been available. Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. But let us also stop to think that we want a Christian home in a day like this. But our homes were once unchristian homes, most of our homes. if we were saved after we became adults. Our homes are constantly invaded by non-Christian influences. What our homes are is largely what the world is because of the television, the moving picture, the newspaper, literature of various kinds, and commerce and all. Our homes are very much the same as the non-Christian home. It's very difficult to have a distinguishing feature. Some of us feel we have a sense of Christian identity when the first thing that meets the eye of the guest when he comes in the front door to hang up his coat is prayer changes things, or Christ the same, or this is a Christian home, or something, some label. And if we put such a label as that on our front door, as it were, in our home to identify ourselves, we certainly ought to live up to the obligation we put ourselves under. It's like some automobiles that travel around the country that say Jesus saves on the back of them. And then you know what you automatically do? I do. I can't help it. I watch to see what kind of a driver they are. Did you do that? Unconsciously, you check up on their driving. And so if you put the label in your home, this is a Christian home, and then you want to see, you sort of realize you're being checked up on immediately. I believe, however, that if our Christianity means what we believe it to mean, that we shouldn't be afraid of these labels. That we should put ourselves on record in a sense that I am the Christian that God wants me to be. And if I'm not, I'd better start moving in that direction. Let us think more of some of the problems in our home in terms of, say, let's say, six different categories. One of the problems of the world coming into the home is disunity in the home. Disunity. I mentioned to you once before, it's one thing for the boy to fall into the lake, but it's something much more serious if the lake gets into the boy. Our homes are in the world, but we must establish a sense of identity in this world so that the world does not possess our homes. And one of the marks of a non-Christian home, oftentimes, is disunity. However, I believe if we were to be in the visiting around among homes, we would find that Christian homes sometimes have more disunity in them than non-Christian homes, because there is unity in non-Christian homes, oftentimes. There are qualities among non-Christians that often put Christians to shame. Many people have concluded they'd rather do business with non-Christians than Christians. And it's sad that this should ever be said. It's probably because people have turned to Christianity to support their neurosis rather than to find a change of life. You understand what I'm talking about? If I, as a non-Christian, cannot maintain some sense of control in life, some sense of mastery, then by joining the church and so on, maybe I can get God on my side and I can pray and work and be accepted and this kind of thing and maintain a larger control in my environment and feel better about myself and have some place to blame my failures and I'll be doing the right thing. Everybody will be knowing that I'm a church member. We unconsciously can get into a self-deceiving position here. I don't suppose we would be right in saying that a person who would do this is not actually a Christian. He may or may not be actually saved, but at least he's deceived about some things. All of us can involve Christianity very easily into our neurotic needs without being realistic in our Christian positions. This is one of the burdens I've had as I've been talking to you about how the Bible relates to our Christian position in terms of identity, is to help you to see how to use your Christianity in a realistic way. And unconsciously, you'll be defending against your neurosis. If you start moving up the ladder, for instance, in the various stages of maturation, knowing what maturity is, knowing what identity is, how to be of service to humanity, what it really means to feel like a person, and how to get it from the Scripture, then you say, I have given you the tools to defend against taking Christianity in a neurotic way. You know then how to live Christianity in a realistic way. Disunity is a problem that we practically have to face barefisted. And if you want to overcome disunity in your home, then you have to face it as a problem, just like you face a bill that comes in the mailbox. You have to figure out some way to pay it. You have to work on this disunity with all of the intellect and leading of the Spirit that you know how to get a hold of. Provide relationships with those that you feel disconnected to. Make romance a possibility in the home, for instance. I don't recall telling you of, if I've told you in other words, forgive me. I don't recall telling you of a lady that came to me once upon a time, say 3 years ago, I believe, who said, I don't believe I'm doing enough for Jesus. What are you doing for the Lord? Well, she said, I get so depressed because I just have a sense of failure all the time. My husband and I are Bible school graduates. We are busy in our church. My husband's a choir director. We teach Sunday school and so on. But we just don't seem to be accomplishing anything. Now, this was her leading symptom of depression. So I said, tell me more. What do you do? This is what she said. Sunday morning, I teach a Sunday school class. My husband leads the choir. He teaches a Sunday school class, too. Now, you'd think I'd be about enough, wouldn't you? Sunday evening, we sponsor the high school young people's group. And he leads the evening choir, made up mostly of high school. It's two choirs. What about Monday? Oh, Monday is a boys' club meeting, and my husband is a sponsor in the boys' club meeting. So he's out Monday night. What about Tuesday night? I'm a sponsor in a girls' club meeting, and I must be out Tuesday night. He sits with the kids while I'm gone, and I sit with the kids, of course, while he's gone. Wednesday night. Well, that's prayer meeting, and we have choir practice after prayer meeting. And we want to get our young people to prayer meeting so they get in the habit of going to prayer meeting. And we have a young people section in our prayer meeting, and so we must be at prayer meeting, of course, every Wednesday night. And we are very faithful about this. Thursday night, I was hoping there was some place here in the week that they would have time to rest. Thursday night, well, we have to prepare for that Sunday night young people service, so and the young people have to learn how to develop leadership. And so on, and so they come over to our house every Thursday night and prepare for the next Sunday night meeting. Friday night. My husband and I work with them, you see. Friday night. Well, Friday night is a night for various things. Friday night, she said, is a night once in a while, probably once or twice a month, depending on what night we have free, that our young people go to a roller skating or do something, and of course being the leading sponsors, we have others that help, but being the leading sponsors, we must be there. What about the other Friday nights that you are, you said when you're free, you go with the young people. What about the others? Well, my husband is a deacon, and they have deacons meeting on Friday night so that he can come. They choose that night of the week. That's one night a month, then. What about another one? Well, you see, he's also a trustee. And the trustees meet that night. On the other night. Is there ever a free Friday night? Maybe once every 2 or 3 months there might be a free Friday night. But usually somebody comes over from the church to visit or something is going on. Have you had a free Friday night this year? I don't recall any. What about Saturday? Your husband works 40 hours a week, yes. What about Saturday? Well, ours is a young church, and we're always building. Now, this is a Western custom. I don't know whether you do it here or not, but they employ the free labor in the church. So the men all get together in the men's brotherhood and so forth. Oh, yes, I meant to say the men's brotherhood meet on Friday night, and he's part of that. And the men's brotherhood, or the men of the church, have a work team that works on Saturday morning, at least, or part Saturday. And when he doesn't absolutely have to repair something at the house, he's down at the church working. Saturday night, I thought, sure, there'd be one night. What happened Saturday night? Well, she says, we want to win souls for Christ. Our church is a zealous church, and our pastor is a very zealous man. And so he has challenged us to have a prayer meeting on Saturday night, especially for certain men of the church that really are in the leadership position to get together and pray for souls on Sunday morning. And so there's always a prayer meeting on Saturday night. You're not doing enough for Jesus? She still didn't get the point. No, I just don't feel like we're doing enough. It just seems so futile. You see what was wrong, don't you? I said, didn't you marry your husband because you love him? Yes. Didn't he marry you because he loved you? Yes. Isn't that part of God's will for your life, that you have some romance in your life? Yes. Well, when do you have it? Yes, we don't. Do you and your husband have a good relationship together? She says, we're getting awfully snappy. He comes in, all nervous, tense, eats his food, hurries out to a meeting, comes back dead tired, flops into bed, gets up the next morning, goes to work. That's the way it goes all the time. We never have any time for fellowship. But we're trying to serve the Lord. Well, I said, now, haven't we got things kind of mixed up in values here someplace? Don't we read the same Bible? Doesn't it say in Timothy that if you can't manage your home, you don't qualify in the church? If your home falls apart, how long are you going to testify in the church? How long are you going to serve if your home falls apart? Don't you see what's wrong? You're feeling a failure. Not, you think it's in the church, but you're so lonesome, both of you, that you're getting angry about it. You feel rejected by each other. And you're feeling this emptiness, and you think it's because you're not serving the Lord well enough, when really, you've just missed your set of values that God has given you. You belong to your husband. You need some romance. You need some of love life in your own home. Your home is important too. In fact, I would put it that your home has a primary place, because if you can't manage the home, you can't work in God's house. You have to work in both. Both are of value, but the prime place is the home. Christianity has to start there in the home. And then it can be worked out at the church. It can be also revealed to others. Well, what in the world are we going to do? Well, will you follow my advice? I have a plan for you if you'll follow it. Yes, tell me what in the world to do. I said, drop a lot of jobs. Don't let yourself get involved with more than, well, perhaps most people can only stand one job in the church. That's about all they can really do well. Folks like you with training maybe have 2 or at the most 3 jobs in the church. But the rest of them, cut them. Give yourself home life. That's God's will for you, as far as I know anything about God's will. Well, she says, there's nobody to do the work. They're all depending on us. Nobody could do what we're doing. That's why we're doing it. You know what I felt like saying? You have a grandiose opinion of yourself, don't I? Don't you? That's what I wanted to say. But I might have said something like that, because I told her, I said, Forget it. You're not that important. You're dispensable. Suppose you were sick and in a hospital and maybe you had a heart attack or something, one of you, and you couldn't go back. You're absolutely cut off the work. All of it had to go. Would the church fold up? Well, I don't suppose so. Well, then, just pretend you had a heart attack. And the doctor said that you can't do it. And make me the doctor if you want. I'll write the prescription. You've got to cut it all out, but a couple of jobs, that's all. And tell the people at the church you can't do any more of it. That they're going to have to take this and this and this. Now I'll let you decide what to drop off. You pray about it. But get rid of at least half your load. At least half. Cut it down to two, at the most three jobs. She saw the wisdom of it. She talked it over with her husband. And they prayed about it. And they reduced their level of activity, as I suggested. I saw her later, and she said, "Thank you so much for the advice. We now are happy in the service of the Lord. I don't somehow feel depressed anymore." Their home, I believe, will be a happy Christian home for children to grow up in. Here were two children, I mentioned this to her too, who were not having a mom and daddy like they should, especially a daddy. The absent father, and all of the distortions that come in the personality because of it. And yet children, his children, were his primary responsibility. And he was making other people's children his primary responsibility. Christians can get mixed up in their values because of their compulsive drives to do more for Christ. And I believe, Brother John, that as pastors we need to preach this balance in living so that people don't get so involved in church life that they forget other values. The church is not the home, nor the home the church. They both have an important function together in the community to make the Christian community a real testimony to the world. And God has prescribed a pattern of happiness. And by the way, when these people gave up the jobs, they got a big surprise, just as I told them they would. I knew it would happen because as a pastor, I've seen it happen before. Their jobs were picked up by others right away, and they were happy to find a place where they could serve the Lord too. And folk took jobs that they didn't think ever could do anything. The people themselves didn't believe they could do it, but the Lord laid it on their hearts, showed them that He could. And used them. And everybody got a blessing then. Several others got a blessing. They were being robbed of a blessing by their compulsiveness to serve. The church is for everybody to serve in. And the home is where we really live in such a way that we can serve in the church. It prepares us for Christian service more than the church prepares us for home living. There's a balance here, and there's a relative value. This was a little bit larger than the subject of disunity, but let's take the second, irresponsibility. General selfishness, we've talked about that, little sharing, irresponsibility. People dodging responsibility in the home, letting others take the responsibility that they have. For instance, I have a definite reaction to sex education being taught in the schools. Not that it's wrong for school authorities to teach it. Somebody had better teach it. But I believe it should be taught by the parents. So it won't be necessary for the school to teach it. Parents are missing the sweetest, most precious experience with their children that they can have by not learning how to share these precious facts of life with their children at the proper time. You wonder sometimes, who is the parent and who is the child? As though the parent stands around with his finger in his mouth, I wonder how I'm going to broach the subject. When the child is saying, well, what do you want to know, Dad? Or what do you want to know, Mom? Oftentimes, children are in rebellion to a larger extent in their teens because they're so irritated and disappointed with their parents that they didn't help them with their sex thoughts a little earlier. The parents didn't seem to be interested. The child had to turn from the parent. He didn't want to somebody else. He resented that, and it shows up in some other rebellious behavior that you can't depend upon the parents. There's a break in relationship, you see, because of the irresponsibility of the parent. Let somebody else teach them. I can't. You talk about it. And it's unfortunate. Mothers will say to the husband, you tell them about it. I can't talk about it. Or husbands say, that's your job. You're the mother. You tell them all about it. And mother sometimes can, and father sometimes can, but most of the time they say, well, can't we get this in the education in the school, or can't the Sunday school teacher tell them or something? But there's a problem. As soon as you bring sex education into the church, watch out. There'll be parents get all irate. The church is out of its bounds. They're talking about sex stuff down at the church. I've known of pastors and youth directors to be discharged from their positions simply because they tried to help some children out with their problems, and they were doing it in an absolute discreet way. The only problem was they didn't take a witness along to defend them, and the parents were misunderstanding the situation. Even though they had a group of young people and teaching them, they didn't have some adult witnesses in the group to defend them when the problem came up as an accusation. This is the only way that a person can really handle, a leader like a youth director or something can handle some of these sex education problems, is that the church gives him permission to do it and puts witnesses in the group to protect him in case some of the neurotic parents or parents that feel that they're getting out of bounds at the church and start making accusations. Then you've got witnesses to prove what you've said. It's dangerous to bring sex education into the church. For this reason, people don't want you to talk about it. The church is supposed to talk about the Lord and salvation, but don't tell people anything about their problems. I'm not angry about it. I'm disappointed that we have to read about sex in the Bible but can't talk about it from the pulpit, when that's a very important part of life. Irresponsibility at this point has caused many, many, many problems. The respect for authority is low in this matter of responsibility. The low respect for authority, the authority of the local government, is often destroyed in the home by an over-discussion of politics and telling, in front of the children at least, letting the children realize that we've got a bunch of crooked politicians in, and the police department is corrupt, and you can't get things through the law courts and all this sort of thing. Instead of upholding the dignity of the government that we have, there is dignity there, even though there's lots of corruption. They do try to represent dignity, and if you talk with the people who are in politics and you get personally acquainted with them, there are very few of them that aren't at least trying to discharge most of their responsibilities in an honorable and a decent way, according to the book, the way they're supposed to do. They handle their duties. And we do have dignity in our government. And our young people and children need to feel responsible to the law of the land. God holds us this way. In more than one place in the New Testament, he specifically says, obey the law of the land. Honor the king, pray for him, and so on. This is very important, that we uphold dignity and order. And if we didn't have the laws that we have, and if our officials were not handling things as well as they are, we'd certainly have chaos, that's for sure. The Watts riot would have been playthings. It would have been all over the place. And I hope that we don't have any more recurrence of these things. It's terrible. But it can happen. Sometimes we need riots like this to get some cleaning up in politics. You know what I mean? There's always a clearing of the air after the storm. We correct things when we see we have to. Not that I'm for any riots. That isn't really the way to handle it. But my interest now is talking about our sense of responsibility to our government and to uphold the government that we do have before our children so that they may feel responsible to our government for law and order and the school authorities so that they respect their teachers. Sure, they've got a bad teacher. They got the worst teacher this year they've ever had. You may know it, but try to uphold something good in that teacher so that the child, after all, he's stuck with her. What can he do about it? If it's an impossible situation, you might be able to do something about it. But most of the time, these teachers, while they may have some personality problems, they are still doing the best they know how. And if you go down and talk to the teacher a little bit, perhaps something can be worked out so that there's better understanding. But the parent needs this sense of responsibility. Third, low communication. This business of confiding. In the Christian home, we need to build confidence. And I think I've given you several suggestions of how to do it. When you show this fourth dimensional love, as we talk about, this fourth stage love, this expendable love to your children, you're going to be interested in them for their welfare, and that's going to open them up so that they're going to come to you and talk to you. Because you're going to accept them even though they differ from you. You cannot be shocked by them. You accept them, the person, regardless of their deeds and their actions, and this gives them an openness to you, a confidence. They love you for that. Communication between the mother and father is primary. Then that can work out communication between the mother and the father and the children. However, when it's impossible, as it is oftentimes in some homes where they're unequally yoked together, and there seems to be an unbridgeable chasm between mother and father, then of course each parent should do the best they can to maintain a communication with the children. But low communication is so prevalent in the Christian home. 16-year-old young lady was brought to me by a father and mother who were terribly upset. The girl had been chasing around and stayed out all night, and they weren't sure whether she was with a boy or a girlfriend. She said she was with a girlfriend, but she'd had a boyfriend, and they weren't really sure what had happened. And they were very upset. Fine Christian people, upset to the core. What'll people think of us and all that kind of thing? And what about our daughter? And the father had been an army sergeant, and he had tried to maintain his home like as if he had a regiment in front of him that he was in charge of. And this is the way he handled his home, just like he handled the men when he was in the army. And I mean it, he really gave this girl every kind of severity, just like that. He had no compassion for her feelings. He didn't get any communication back from her that he could accept. If she didn't do it just the way he thought it ought to be done, he started forcing her. And yet, at the same time, he would brag about all the liberties he gave her. And true, he had given many liberties to her that were due to her, but at the same time, she was to use her liberties the way he wanted her to. There are subtle ways of giving liberty but not giving it. This giving without giving is a very interesting thought. We very seldom really give anything. Especially when we have to maintain mastery. We give without really giving. And children need to feel that, at that age, at least at 16, that you do trust them with something, that you have given something to them as far as their own independence is concerned. And she didn't feel trusted. We finally worked out most of the problem before the father decided he'd brought his daughter long enough. And she, in the meantime... fell in love with a fine young man, and they are married. So father said, "That's great." He says, "She's off of my hands. She's his problem now." In other words, she had changed regiments. She had been transferred. The The next problem that I'd like to speak about is the problem of materialism and pleasure-centered thoughts, that everybody seems to be in a whirl of social clubs and activities outside of the home instead of making a home a primary place for activity. I don't know whether this applies so much here or not. Maybe it does. I hear that there are many social clubs, and perhaps this is one reason I should speak of this. Clubs can seem to the children to take away the affection of the parents from them. They can be very jealous of the parents' extracurricular, extra home, I should say, activities, when they become a force that robs them of the love of the parent. Now, I'm sure the children, it's healthy for the children to give up the parents once in a while. I won't say just how much, because that wouldn't be quite right. It would vary some, but certainly once a week or so. But to be giving up the parent night after night, day after day, to some outside interest, causes the child to feel rejected and jealous, and this is hostility. And then later on, the parent says, "I don't know. I've provided everything for this child. Why in the world are they so rebellious?" I remember a woman coming to me in the throes of a nervous breakdown when we lived in Chicago. And she was a very dear person, right at the threshold of accepting Christ. And one of the first things that we took care of was her soul's relationship with God. This was a great help. And her anxieties quieted and all. And then she told me, after we talked about many of the symptoms, we got down to the one thing that really had thrown her into the breakdown, or really built her anxiety up beyond the point of control. She and her 18-year-old daughter were talking. And she had raised this girl more or less alone, since the father had deserted her when the girl was less than a year old. And she had done the best she could with the girl. Best she knew how, I'm quite sure. But she said to her daughter, "I don't see how you can treat me this way. How could you act to me this way? You act as if I don't care for you at all. You're just so unconcerned. You just seem so cold toward me. And I've done everything for you. I've given my life for you. How can you act this way to me?" You can imagine how a mother might talk like this to her daughter. And the daughter was old enough, 18, to take this very maturely. And she looked at her mother with deliberation, thoughtfulness, and she says, "Yes, mother, you're right. You have done everything you knew how to do for me. You've sacrificed greatly for me. You've given me everything under the sun." Mother interrupted and said, "Yes, I have." She says, "I've bought you toys. I bought you, when you were a little girl, I bought you every toy in the book, practically. I provided the best nurseries I could. You provided," and the daughter then took away, "Yes, and you bought me clothes, and you bought me everything. You gave me everything but what I really wanted." "What in the world are you talking about? You gave me everything but love." "Oh, my dear, what do you mean? I was giving you love. You think that I worked in that restaurant and slaved those long hours just because I was doing it just for toys? I was slaving there thinking of my little girl at home and doing everything I could for her so that she would enjoy life while I was having to be away to earn a living. And I sacrificed. I wore rags practically many times, not buying what I needed, so that you would have something nice. You call that no love?" "But," she says, "I didn't have you. I had things. I didn't have you." And this cracked the woman up. She had misunderstood what love is. It isn't things. It isn't the pleasantness of life. It's relationship. It's relationship. And so clubs and social activities can cause a rupture in the basic relationships of the home if they get to be an obsessive need. You're defending against relating to the home sometimes. Oftentimes, men get involved with men's clubs and other things because it isn't pleasant enough to be at home. They don't know how to invest themselves at home in a way that they feel a value and a reward there. And so, since they feel a failure at home and feel inferior at home, they go to the place where they can build in superiority. Look at my golf score. It's better than so-and-so's. I beat him today. See, they're building superiority when at the same time might be invested at home with the same amount of exercise, but he would feel inferior. And by the way, I'd like to say something of this to you, dear ladies. The men here can just bear with me and say amen. I think you will. It's a very easy thing for your husband at home to feel inferior to you because you have time to read, you have time to go to church, you have time with your Bibles, and what does he do? He's out there in that living. He's facing the world and its dirt and all of the filth there, and he comes home feeling crummy and all that kind of thing because he's been with the world, and here you are, lily white, clean and holy, and he feels all dirty and crummy. And he feels inferior. And before you know it, you have given him the feeling. He's very sensitive at this point, you see. And you've implied the feeling that you're holier than he is, that he ought to do something, and that you're burdened about his soul, that you're burdened that he is not the Christian he ought to be. And he ought to be doing more about it. Why don't you read more? Why don't you do more? When actually, the guy just wants to rest. He wants to feel like a king in his household, and he feels more like a servant, that he's being used, that his salary is the only thing interesting to you. And that all he gets is this holier-than-thou treatment when he comes home. Now, I'm sure if you recognize this, if it is a problem in your home, that you will defend against it, that you will try to give him an honor and a dignity for the fine man that he is, and not be trying to make him into the person that you are, or that you hope that he would be, but love him. He's giving himself for you and his home. And as you love him, show him real love for the person he is, regardless of some of the dirty tracks into the house, I mean worldly things, you'll motivate him to be interested in what you're interested in. But when he doesn't have this feeling of being at least equal to you, that's what he should have, this one-to-one feeling of deep respect on your part for everything that he is, then he will begin to have a feeling of rejection or a feeling of inferiority. Remember what I said, the three ways that you feel hostility is because of humiliation or rejection or frustration. He'll start defending against it with hostility, and as a result, he won't want to go your way. He'll not have the motivation to be interested in the church life and in the Bible that he could have in the time that you think he has time. You could not watch that boob tube so much, and you could read your Bible a little bit more. How come you have to stay home on Sunday morning and just look at the funny paper or the... You see what I mean? And every time you start controlling him, you defeat the very thing you're trying to accomplish. When God put you in the home, to love him. Because love will motivate him to be like you. To enjoy you for your interests. And then you can have a testimony. If I want you to appreciate my testimony, I'm certainly not going to make you mad at me. All right? Well, take it for what it's worth. I've been wanting to say that for some time. Another weakness that we have is romance. As I've indicated, the family needs to take time for romance. It took me several years of marriage before I caught on to my own neglect here. And it has made a great improvement, though, in our own sense of fulfillment, my wife and me, though it never got to a place where we were at much tension about it, though I began to sense that we were both hungry for something in our love life. And I didn't know what. Our home life seemed to be going dead by dry rot, so to speak. It just wasn't what it ought to be. I can honestly say that we've not quarreled in all of our marriage, and it's been wonderful. But it's largely because we have a promise that we'll never go to sleep on tension. We'll always discuss our problems before we go to sleep. We started that with a promise right upon our marriage day, and we've kept that, and it's been a wonderful thing. But at the same time, you can sense a deadness creeping in to the relationship. And I began to explore what's going on here, because this isn't the way God planned things. And both of us are becoming disappointed in our relationship. And then I began to check things out, and I say, boy, am I working for the Lord? I'm working for the Lord, and I'm actually working against the Lord in my own home, because I'm too busy outside and not enough busy inside. And so I took it upon myself to ask my wife for a date. And you know what kind of response I got? She wasn't too busy. No, sir. And we became sweethearts again. And it was so much fun. We've done it quite often. Go and play together. Just like sweethearts. In fact, it restored the sweetheart feeling to our marriage. And it dissipated all the deadness. Even though there's lots of work, and sometimes we're kept apart for periods of time, when we are together, we always have this sweet feeling of oneness. When we're apart, it's not as it isn't as though we were being rejected by each other. We're always longing for that time to be back together again, because we're trying to keep romance alive. Why should the honeymoon ever be over? Why should the bells ever stop ringing? We got married because of romance. Why shouldn't we stay married in romance? That's the purpose. We never wanted this ecstasy to die. Why let it? And you know, a date is very good. And you know, I happen to notice the calendar. Next Monday night would be a good time for you to suggest to your husband you'd be available for a date. You know what the day is, don't you? The romance also must be between the parents and the children in the sense of love and affection shown. Homes can be the deadest place as far as affection. Young lady, 21 years of age, engaged to a young man, says, you know, he's wonderful, but I'm embarrassed to take him to our house. I've never once seen my mother and father show any affection. I said, how in the world did they ever have you? I said, I don't know. I suppose they may have affection someplace, but she says, I never seen any of it. I says, I'm so embarrassed because the fellow I have is affectionate and I like it. He comes over and we sit on the davenport and he holds my hand and he puts his arm around me and so on, and I can see my mother and my father. And mother takes me off in the kitchen and aren't you real sure you're real careful now? And she says, I can hit her. She's implying that I'm not clean morally. She's implying so much, and I don't know what she means by it. As if she's suspicious of me. I've often thought my mother was suspicious of me. See how, if the mother and father had been free with affection, they'd been fine. Well, it just happened. I knew the mother and father real well, and I talked to them about it. I said, "What's the matter? Are you not affectionate?" "Oh, why, yes. But we're always embarrassed to show it in front of the kids." Well, I said, "It's about time you changed your program. Let's see what happens. And if you just show your daughter," I told the husband, I didn't talk to the mother about it, I said, "Show your daughter that you're not afraid to hold your wife's hand or do something like this. Let her realize that your wife, her mother, is attractive to you sexually. Let her realize it by showing some affection. It's very important to her growth." And you know he did? The mother... and she liked it. I get this back from the daughter. "I don't know what's happened. I guess there's a conversion going on in our home. It must be because I'm in love, and they see us loving each other, and so they kind of feel more free." I had something much more subtle to work out in this home, because this girl was going to have trouble in her marriage if her father didn't show affection. Unless you had some psychological training, you'd never guess what I'm getting at. The daughter in this particular setting, and it would be the same in most any daughter, felt attractive to her young man, but she also felt attractive to men, naturally. And she had a reason to feel attractive because she was a little bit more endowed with some of the curves than her mother. And unconsciously in her mind, without realizing it, since her father had never shown her any affection since she was about 11 years of age, when she became 11, she thought her mother might have suggested, "It's time now to quit holding daughter on your lap or something. You better start treating her with a little bit more discreetness." She thought maybe daddy might have said that. Her mother might have said that today, because daddy stopped showing her all affection. Hardly even as much as tapping her on the shoulder or touching her hand. From all that time. And here she grew into an attractive young lady. You see what her problem was? She was afraid. She had a real fear. Quite subconscious as to what the fear was about. So it was just anxiety. But it was a fear that she was more sexually attractive than her mother to her father. And it made her so cold to her dad to defend herself against this that she could hate her father without any problem at all. That her father might have ancestral thoughts toward her, but he was not letting them out because he would be in trouble with mother. And she couldn't work through this, though intellectually she could work through it, but emotionally she couldn't. Because every daughter wants to be attractive to her father. But she doesn't want to be any sexual gratification to her father, of course, but she wants to be attractive to him. But you can't get these two separated until the father separates them. And it worked beautifully. As soon as he began to show, without her knowledge that I had talked to him, show interest in mother, immediately she felt safe with father, and her whole attitude toward father improved. She could then be more outgoing to her father, and she wondered why her interest in her father was improving. "Well, you know, Dad isn't," she says, "I don't know, maybe it's just because I'm engaged or something, but and have a security outside of the home. I don't know what it really is, but somehow or other, I enjoy Dad. I like to talk to him, and our relationship is really warming up. But before, I've heard that girl say, 'I wish he were dead. I wish he were dead.' And he hadn't done a thing." And that's just, "I feel so guilty for wishing this." But you see, she was defending against the possibility of her being too attractive to him. And she didn't want any of the effects of it being attractive, when she needed to feel confident in her own femininity. And that simple little business of showing affection in the home solves so many problems for the children. You have an important role with your sons in a very similar way. Because your sons learn to understand that they are men, attractive to women for their strength and so forth. By the way, you award them feelings of manhood. By the way, you, shall we say, let them be the strong arm that you can lean on. As you give them decisions to make and depend upon their leadership in situations like, which direction shall we go? How do you get here? What do you think about that? As they grow through their teens. Mothers, for goodness sakes, or for the Lord's sake, and for your son's sake, let them feel like men in front of you, even before they're ready for it. Don't keep them dependent upon you. It makes them weak men. This helps them to be strong men, feeling like they have the strength that other women, the woman of their choice someday will admire, and they'll have comfort in their own manhood. See? Just the same as this girl needed comfort from her father in her womanhood. There's nothing complicated about it. It's just be natural. Be a woman with your son. This is our Christian privilege. We can get on and on here too fast, can't we? Let me give you this rapidly. See, I haven't got to the sixth point, but let me just mention this. The sixth point of the weaknesses of our home, and I'll just say it briefly. This one of the weaknesses is the unequal yoke, the divided home. This happens so often. We have one person in the home that is a Christian, another person that isn't, or of a different faith. There's a lot of disagreement here, and it's the a problem that brings about no devotional life, no basic unity on spiritual things. And here, if this happens, the parent who is Christian just has to do the best they can under the limitations and not forget that their primary duty is not Christianity in the sense of being preachy and trying to convert everybody. They must always convert through motivation, and motivation starts with love. Your wife in the home to love that husband. Your husband in the home to love that wife. And out of the love comes the motivation to be like, to be pleasing to. And that's what makes the testimony effective. Now, let me give you ways to strengthen today's home. I'll take just about 5 or 10 minutes. Put them down rapidly if you want to. First, covenant with God that you will have a Christian home. Covenant with God that you'll have a Christian home. Hold the line against all non-Christian influences in the home. This means in terms of literature, TV programs and all. Now, I don't mean that everybody has to say praise the Lord at every breath. But I'm talking about satanic, deceptive, murderous, adulterous influences in the home that are hellish in a sense, devilish. Sure, we have to face the world and all, but let's keep as much of the world out of the home as we can in this way and sanctify our homes so that it'll be honoring to Christ in all of its conduct. Secondly, call on God through prayer. This is a way to strengthen the home. That have encouraged the children to pray. Pray about the small problems as well as the bigger problems. Pray about things that are seemingly unimportant as well as the things that are very important. This helps the children to feel a dependency, know how to pray. And many a child has never heard his parents pray, even though they're professing Christian. Maybe you say, well, I can't say the words just right. Who said you had to? You got a prayer in your heart? You can say something. If you want something, you can always ask for it, and that's all prayer really is, if it's right down at the heart of things. Second is family third is family discussions. Talk things over. This always strengthens the home. Topics of the day, the school, neighborhood problems, whatever is going on, let it come into the home to talk about it so that the children can feel free to discuss with the parents, parents discuss with the children. This gives intercourse in the home, a freedom of communication. Then the family needs to play together. Time for play. We've said something about that already. Family interests in education. This, I think, is very important. That you, as parents, need to take an interest in what the world the kids are doing at school. If they've got a program on at school, an open house, or something in which your children have some part, please go down and see what in the world it's all about. If the child brings home an arithmetic paper or a spelling paper, at least look at it and look it over in terms of the child's interest. That represents part of him, part of his work. I say, oh, don't bother me with it now. Or I don't have time to go down to that PTA meeting or that open house. They'll get along okay without me. There'll be other parents there. You're the only parent that should be there for your child. You see, the child takes pride in his school, and it builds cooperation between him and his teacher, too, if you take an interest. He feels like that you're interested in what it is. Now, you can be overly interested and try to control everything down there. That isn't what I mean. But to show interest, I have so many adults that say, when they come into the counseling room, my parents did not care about me at school. They weren't interested in what was going on down there. They never went to any school program. They didn't even go to my graduation. And I've watched it happen in the pastorate again and again and again. I have gone as a pastor to represent the parents in my mind to some dear child. There'll be several on her graduation who would come up to me afterward with tenderness and affectionate love and say, thank you, Pastor, for coming down to the graduation. My parents didn't even want to come, or something to that effect. I'm so glad you showed interest. This means so much to me. Then, the romance, idea of affection, I mentioned that strengthens the home. Relationships in the home, this church relationship, I should say, the relationships with the church make the church important in the part of the church, of the family activities. The church does have a very important part. And it's a nice thing for you parents to think about as your children grow up. Every age of child in the home, or every age as your child identifies with the church, there is some organization in the church, usually, for your age child. Primary, junior, and junior high and high school, there's some age of activity in the church that represents your age of child. Now, I've never yet seen a church that couldn't use another couple for sponsors in that age of work. Doesn't mean you have to do a lot of work in sense of being there engineering their programs. If a half a dozen parents would all come in and be sponsors of the junior age youth program or the primary age youth program for the church, that would be a whale of a success. You could have them over to your living room for a chocolate or something. They could sing songs at your house maybe once a month, once in 2 or 3 months. You could provide transportation for a half a dozen kids to some outing at the lake or something. This is what sponsoring means. It means just sort of standing by, not overseeing, you'll see if they do it right, but standing by to be of help. Call on me as you need me. Come by once in a while to show interest. Sponsors, supporters of this program. In other words, if you've got children in the junior age department, you should be in that junior age department doing something. Or high school department, be related to it in some way. This gives value to that department in the minds of your child. This gives value to the church in the minds of the child. And this increases helps to diminish your family problems. In conclusion, I'd like to say, according to many passages of Scripture, that marriage vows are never outdated. They never are outdated. They're always current. It's always been my habit to give the couples I marry a copy of the vows they have made. I jokingly say this is so that you can hold it over each other's heads and say, see what you promised. But in reality, it means that they can become nostalgic once in a while and go back and see what they promised. Review the vows, because the vows are always current. They express good intentions. They also express something of moral value and spiritual value. And I hope that your home will be a happier place, a place that is better defended against the pressures of the world from here on. May God bless you.